Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Renal Cell Carcinoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Tony Choueiri from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding program featuring Dr. Choueiri's slide presentation. To begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This patient, I remember 2 years ago, came to see a urologist for hematuria. The urologist did the workup, called me, there was nodules. And I believe they removed the kidney and I started them on Cosmic 313. It was open two and a half years ago. The patient have hypertension, hand-foot skin reaction, and did not need dose reduction, actually. They were all grade two. We managed them. And at cycle 7, day 1, just before we obtained imaging and showed the PR. Now, at that time, after the LFTs being fine, the LFTs came 4 times upper limit of normal. We held therapy. And at that time, we're, looking back and forth, decreasing therapy. And the patient said to us, I want to stop. I don't want to be on trial. You know, every time you come, you have COVID policy. You don't let anyone with me. I just come see you, regular follow up. So we stopped all study treatment. And 9 months after we stopped, so 7 cycles on, 9 months after, I saw the patient recently. And 75% shrinkage, they continue to shrink. It's a durable PR off therapy.
Could I ask you a couple of questions about the case? You mentioned that the patient had had a nephrectomy prior to seeing you, in spite of the fact there was metastatic disease. And I'm curious where things are nowadays with nephrectomy. I noticed you had a paper looking at it in patients who got IOs. But, of course, patients who are symptomatic, have pain, that's one thing. But particularly the asymptomatic patients, what's the current thinking about the role of cytoreductive nephrectomy?
I think, while in the past we did it more, we do it less now based on the French Carmina study, which showed that cytoreductive nephrectomy with sunitinib versus sunitinib only doesn't have, the OS benefit we hope to. Nevertheless, it's practiced still in a considerable number of patients, and it has benefit. Because if you look even at the Carmina patient with one risk factor, with limited disease burden, probably benefit. So patients that have poor risk, patients that have rapidly growing disease, a lot of disease outside the kidney, brain mat, probably not. But, I worry that there are patients, that have limited disease burden that should get the kidney out are not. Like in this patient, despite we counted 15 pulmonary nodules, there was 1 over 1 centimeter, and most of them were less than, 5 millimeter. So, this is not like someone who has 15 pulmonary nodule, all of them over 1 centimeter with liver and bone metastasis. And, the Carmina study was discussed with the patient, all of this. And the decision was, to remove the primary that was, diagnostic. At the same time, this patient was still getting hematuria and needed one-time ER visit and borderline transfusion. He ended up not being transfused and continued to have hematuria and clot and being bothered. So the cytoreductive nephrectomy, you can call it half cytoreductive, half palliative if you want.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point in terms of the hematuria. But I guess once he had that out, he had, kind of low volume disease. I assume he was asymptomatic. And, it kind of gets into the question of this triplet approach, which, you talked about in your talk. At this point you have, disease-free survival. I'm curious where you see things heading. One of the things that I've heard from investigators over the last couple of years is this question of right now, outside of a trial, how do you decide between ipi-nivo and TKI-IO? And one of the things I've heard from people, I don't know if this applies to you as well, is that people are more likely to think about a TKI and IO if they're symptomatic or if they have a lot of disease or if they need a response, which this patient at that point really didn't. Is that kind of the way you look at it? And do you think that adding the IO is going to add anything long-term, particularly related to survival?
Yeah, I think this is a very, very fair question. There is, you know, no doubt. I think this is quite fair. I think, you know, I do think that's in my practice. You have to also remember, Neil, that there are folks still not very comfortable with Nivo-Ipi, with dual immunotherapy. Some in academic centers, some in the community. We tend to send our community doc, a lot of them, you know, most are great oncologists, but there are people that are not comfortable with IO. There's a lot of subtleties in treatment. And you can always say a regimen of Pembroaxi, Pembrolen, Cabo-Nivo does have OS benefit, and the hazard ratio for PFS response rate, the hazard ratio for PFS in every risk category is less than one, and I want to use it. And that is totally fine. In my practice, you're right. That's how I use VEGF-IO, rapidly progressing, significant disease burden, I need a response. But we're also adopted Nivo-Ipi too, especially if you have sarcomatoid histology. I didn't show you slides here, but you know, 5 to 10% of patients have sarcomatoid feature. Some of them have extensive sarcomatoid feature. TKI, as single agent, do not work. And Nivo-Ipi have shown a CR rate close to 20%. Higher than even any VEGF-IO. This is my regimen preferred, and there's a biology around it. Patients have infiltrated T cell, increased expression of the antigen-presenting machinery, on and on. So I think, you know, this is my practice. It's a bit hard. I think the bigger question, honestly, to be honest with you, is now that we have, in terms of drug frontline, okay, Pembro, Nivo, we have Avelumab, you know, those are the approved one. Now, Atezo is not approved in renal cell cancer, but it's a drug that has been one of the first immune checkpoint inhibitors. So the big question is, once a patient have tumor progression on a first line or on adjuvant, as a matter of fact, on adjuvant, should a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor be part of the next line regimen? Like we do sometimes in bevacizumab in ovarian cancer, you know, trastuzumab and HER2 positive, they keep the drug. And I don't know that, but I've seen practices all around me that keep it because the regimen is packaged as one. And a first line regimen is given sometimes fourth line or fifth line. I've seen an axi-avelumab given six line because that is the data from frontline. Maybe it's true. So that's why we have those two trials, TNivo-2 and CONTACT-3. I believe these are very important to the field.
Any clinical pearls about using Ipi-Nivo? You know, now you actually have another anti-CTLA-4. It was just approved for HCC, tremelimumab. So I don't know how that's going to... I don't know. I think it's being studied in renal. There's a study with, I think I've seen a study with durvalumab and tremelimumab in renal.
In adjuvant. A group in the UK with James Larkin and Tom Powell's large group international are studying it in adjuvant. That's the one, the adjuvant study happening in the UK by the name Rampart. But you're right. And it's surprising after so much approval for Ipi and Ipi being around and the CTLA-4 principle was before PD-1, PD-L1. To see Tremi approved now, my question is it too little, too late? I don't know. And there is no data that shows Tremi is better than Ipi or Ipi better than Tremi. I don't know.
The one thing I wonder about is toxicity. One of the things that was interesting about the Durva-Tremi HCC trial is they just gave one dose of the Tremi. And I don't know whether they, you know, it's hard to compare the tolerability, but what do you see that's most problematic with Ipi-Nivo in these patients? Is it colitis or this patient had LFTs? But what are the problems that you see with anti-CTLA-4 that are the most problematic?
I think colitis and hepatitis are, the two big ones, and they're problematic because they could be, if they're on nevo-ipi, that's easy. But the problem when we have a TKI on board, nevo, cabo, pembrolizumab, or even on COSMIC 313, nevo, ipi, cabo, which one is which? There are tricks and clinical pearls, stopping the TKI, see what happens, but sometimes it is hard. I just had a patient who is on VEGF-IO, and I was quite sure, actually the email came today from the GI doc, I was quite sure that that was the TKI, but the patient was scheduled anyhow for colonoscopy. You know how hard to get it in this day and age. So we did it. We were able to get it like in 2-3 days. And actually, they do have ICI colitis. And we would stop the TKI, and their diarrhea would go, in 24 hours down by 80%. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the TKI. And actually, they exhibited on the biopsies sign of ICI colitis. So sometimes you don't know. I think that is, so they need steroid. That has been the challenge, with the colitis and the hepatitis.
When you do use a TKI-IO combination off a clinical trial, which one do you usually choose?
So I use usually pembrolizumab or cabo-nivo. If I need a short half-life for the TKI, for whatever reason, patient going to get surgery, maybe pembroaxin. But pembrolizumab and cabo-nivo, pembrolizumab has the highest response rate, highest CR, but also has the highest rate of favorable patient. Cabo-nivo has the quality of life data, the bone mets data, and has the lowest, favorable risk among the doublet. But when I can use nevo-ipi, I use nevo-ipi too.
When you use lenvatinib pembro, what starting dose of lenvatinib do you use, and what do you usually find in terms of how patients tolerate it?
Yeah, I tend to use, there has been few exceptions in people that, I know the blood pressure barely controlled, where I've started at lower, like 14, I usually start at 20, and the vast majority of patients need dose reduction. I have one patient, I think, still on 20 in my practice still.
Yeah, we hear the same thing from the gynecologic oncologist in terms of endometrial cancer. Let's take a look at your next case.
So this is a 61-year-old female, recently diagnosed with metastatic, because I have a practice now for 15 years, so somewhat recently, for therapy initiation for clear cell RCC. She came a second opinion. We started her, probably she's been like less than a year on Len Pembro, Len 20. You were just saying that. After 3 cycles, 40% shrinkage. Despite if you do the grading, the fatigue is grade 2, but when you add all the fatigue grade 2, hand-foot-skin reaction grade 2, the fatigue was intolerable. It was not due to anemia, to hypothyroidism. So we kept reducing Len, and now it's 10. It's manageable. No immune-related AE whatsoever. And she continues alternating 8 and 10. And I did discuss with her. I saw that patient a week before you contacted me. So I looked at my clinic, et cetera. And I discussed with her that if she remains in she has a partial response, I plan to stop the Pembro after 2 years. So she's been on Pembro, 10, 11 months.
Yeah, I was going to ask
and
you
I don't know if I will stop. I don't know if I will stop the lenvatinib at that time or not. Usually you continue, but I may actually, I have a patient with brain metastases coming that I came to me for second opinion and decided to stay here on been a year on pembrolizumab decided to stay in Boston, moved to Boston, significant side effects on lenvatinib, but what did not, like we were able to manage it, but at the same time, patient said no. And 4 months ago, we stopped the lenvatinib, continued Pembro, and they have not progressed. Sometimes it's the TKI, sometimes it's the IO, sometimes it's both. You don't know which, so you have to try.
So I'm curious, you know, your first patient who had the LFT abnormalities, you stopped treatment and the patient's still doing well, whether you think there's any correlation between IO toxicity or treatment toxicity and treatment benefit.
Well, I would say yes. There is data from the time of TKI that usually toxicity, meaning the drug is getting into your system, is TKI. So we have the data with hypertension. We have the data with Hand-Foot-Skin reaction, with Lor Michelson. With IO, too, there is data that patients that develop immune-related AEs tend to respond better. But as you know, in our practice, we have patient developing immune-related AE that don't respond, and we have patient with zero side effects from immunotherapy that do respond. So it's not a, you know, we've seen it all.
So I want to go back and just chat a little, you know, explore a little bit more some of the topics that you got into as you were going through your talk. First, in terms of adjuvant treatment, and I'm curious right now how you approach this outside a clinical trial setting and what your experience has been using Pembro in the adjuvant setting.
Well, the experience has been quite favorable. You have to discuss the patient, the data with Pembro on KEYNOTE-564 and the other studies. You have discussed that we have yet no OS benefit. It may never come. I'm confident that things going to be good because I'm an oncologist, so I'm always, you know, a positive guy here. But, you know, this is not a hazard ratio of one that we expect to get better. There are some signs that things look good. I follow the eligibility criteria of KEYNOTE-564. That's the easiest thing, and that's the thing that's in the majority of my patients. So, of course, we see a benefit in a disease-free survival. Hazard ratio last was 0.63.
Any thoughts, further thoughts about all the other negative adjuvant trials going on? And why you still see only one that's really positive?
You know, the one is not, I don't think that was the unicorn here that, you know, no, I think it's the largest study to begin with. That's something we need to emphasize. The eligibility criteria and the risk grouping is different. It is possible, as we discussed, that the PD-1 strategy is better and more efficacious than a PD-L1 strategy. We've seen that in renal cell cancer in the advanced setting. We've seen that in bladder cancer when the studies were similar. You know, the Pembro and the Atezo experience, as you know, in post-chemotherapy in the metastatic setting. We can say it's trial design as much as we want, but it's keep repeating itself. Even in the adjuvant setting in bladder, the Atezo study did not work. The Nivo study did work. Like, how much we gonna say, you know, accuse trial design could be the drug in this setting. Nivo Ipi, you know, is more toxic than single agent IO. That could have synced the study with Checkmate 914. That study has one arm left not reported of single agent Nivo. 6 months. That would be a very good option sometimes if it's positive, because it will decrease the treatment from one year to 6 months. But we have to see, you know, the magnitude of the benefit. And the 6 months is enough to translate into benefit and into potentially an overall survival benefit. And then the PROSPER study, we really had high hopes. Great study, great effort from investigator. I was part of the study, our center. But 20% of patients don't have clear cell renal cell cancer. And I believe that deep down, the classification on PROSPER to get on study is a radiologic classification. Even if we end up with a lot of patients with pathologic T3, it's a radiologic classification. So that's why we end up with 10% of patients with stage one, PT1. So you add all those things, a trial that is smaller, then you can explain why something perhaps failed. But at the end of the day, these are all hypotheses, and the data is the data.
So this idea of PD-1 versus PD-L1, you don't hear too much about that in general in checkpoint trials. You mentioned, though, that some examples, though. When you think about the mechanism, does it make it? I mean, my understanding is PD-L1 grabs the ligand, PD-1 hits the receptor. Is that too simple, or is that the way you view it? And why do you think it would make a difference?
I think, you know, with PD-1, you block PD-L1 and PD-L2. There may be a role for that. It could be simply the drugs. These are different drugs. They have different affinity. The epitopes are different that all could be that. It's, you know, not that different from, TKI. At some point, we can't just lump them all, although we do it all the time, as IO. Like the IO field, but that's an easy way to think about it. But again, especially with the Pembro data, I mean, this remains the largest study. So, you know, we can say whatever we want about it. Now, of course, I'm also conflicted as the PI of the study, as you know, but it is the largest, and I would love to have an OS benefit. I think it will be very important because in adjuvant, as you know, Neil, it's not just renal or bladder or GU. In any adjuvant, there is a group of patients that is cured with surgery only. Maybe we can identify that group with circulating tumor ctDNA, but it's not happening in renal cell. The renal cell doesn't shed a lot of cancerous DNA. But in other tumors, like bladder, like colorectal, it's beginning, you know, we're starting to see some very interesting results. I think the future is bright and there will be more personalized medicine coming.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about circulating DNA because I think you were mentioning the Atezo adjuvant trial, and I think there was an analysis looking at that based on ctDNA, and I seemed like it was kind of more positive when you looked at it that way. But so you're saying like liquid biopsy is not very useful in renal cell?
It's less useful today based on the technologies we have. And you're right. The Atezo study in bladder cancer, by the way, bladder, not kidney.
Right.
Reanalyzed by Dr. Tom Powell's, showed significant result. If you're in those 36% of patients that were ctDNA positive, there's a significant, not just disease-free survival, but an overall survival benefit. In the 67% of patients that were ctDNA positive, the hazard ratio is over 1. So that's a great way. We have not done that experiment in renal cell with the same test, but there is preliminary data in renal cell cancer using the same assay used in bladder cancer that worked from Fox Chase with, close colleagues of ours that show that the sensitivity is less than 50%. The specificity is great, but the sensitivity is like 40, 45%. That's very low. You can't just, you know, that's very low. So, and would that beat the clinical staging, the criteria we came up with, intermediate, high M1 NED? I don't know. The time that we designed the study, Neil, there was no ctDNA. There was not even, there barely any discussion about it. This is different today.
For sure. Let's talk a little bit more about metastatic disease. And I'm curious, again, outside a clinical trial setting, how you approach second-line therapy. So second-line theripy in a patient who had ipi-nivo, second-line therapy in a patient who had TKI-IO.
Well, I think the first question, both of them, my standard outside clinical trial is a TKI that hasn't been used. So if it's Pembro, Axi, Pembro, Len, Cabo, if it's Cabo-nivo, let's say, is, you know, axial or leniverolimus, of course. Tivozanib is another option, absolutely. If it's nivo-ipi, mostly cabozantinib I have been using. Based on the, you know, accumulation of data, you can use also tivozanib, you know, axitinib. You know, but the bigger question, as I said, is do we continue? So let's say you have nivo-ipi and there is progression. You know, why not using cabo-nivo? I want to continue nivo. Well, I've seen that in the community. I have not done it. I have not done it. But that's why we have two trials asking that important concept, because it's possible that we still need to block that PD-1 axis.
So I was going to ask you, though, about adjuvant. There was an adjuvant everolimus study also, correct?
That is correct. That was presented at the last ASCO meeting, and it was negative.
So, yeah, that was I was curious when I saw that getting presented. What about non-clear cell RCC, adjuvant therapy there, as well as the treatment of metastatic disease? Anything new in that regard?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, in non-clear cell RCC, of course, in the adjuvant setting, not much. We have to wait for some subgroup analysis, you know, that come from studies that involve non-clear cell, although there isn't much when you look at, I think Prosper presented some subgroup. In metastatic disease, we're seeing activity with VEGF-IO. So cabo-nivo has been presented most recently at ESMO pembrolizumab, response rate over 50%. The problem with non-clear cell RC is the multiple tumors that are included. So you know, we're knowing that, for example, chromophobe renal cell doesn't respond much to IO-based regimen. Leniverolimus, you know, seems to be the most active there. You know, cabozantinib, there is a trial that focused there was a trial in papillary RCC, non-selected based on the mutations or genomic profile that showed cabozantinib has superior PFS and response rate than sunitinib. That's the PAPMET study. This was published in The Lancet. We also have studies that are ongoing looking at specific MET inhibitors, savolitinib, for example, in MET-dependent and MET-driven papillary RCC, those 40% of patients that have MET alteration, mutations, amplification of the gene, etc. So we are doing some work there. We recently finished single-cell sequencing with our group here, with Dr. Van Allen, Hansky, and Braun looking and Shukla looking at single cell sequencing in chromophobe RC, which, you know, it's a rare tumor. And we found it to be really, we know why it's a cold tumor. There isn't expression of checkpoint, no infiltration by the T cell. So this tumor, you know, that I've given sometimes nivo-ipi, especially if there is some sarcomatoid feature, but it should be treated not with immunotherapy. So we are scratching the surface of non-clear cell RCC.
Anything new in terms of predictors of benefits to IOs? I see that you have this omnivore paper on PD-1 expression in circulating tumor cells. Anything helpful at all right now in predict tumor mutation burden, PD-L1, anything predicting benefit?
You know, renal cell is one of the tumor where biomarkers die. But we have, so the TMB, the PD-L1 expression, not very useful in practice, but we're looking at specific gene signature at some immunofluorescence marker with my partner, Dr. Sabina Signoretti in the lab, Dr. David Braun, Bill Kaling, Kathy Wu, Ellie Van Allen. We're looking at that using a lot of genomic data. You know, one of the things with biomarker, you need a lot of patient. You need really a driven hypothesis that's been perhaps you're validating, and if the discovery now with some elegant newer technologies we're doing, but nothing ready, I think, for prime time. Omnivore, just to remember these studies, Omnivore was one of several studies that attempted to see if we can start by a PD-1 inhibitor and based on the response, add the CTLA-4 after, because, you know, toxicity two at the same time more than one. Actually, this strategy have not succeeded. Because when you add them, the response rate is way lower than the 42%, which is, or the 40%, which is on Nivo-Ipi when you give them concomitant. But the other thing, Neil, despite there are patients that benefited and were spared the CTLA-4, the problem is when you don't have a response and you want to add them, there's a significant attrition rate that the patient are not fit enough anymore to get the second drug, or there is a bad progression, or whatever reason. So this is not a strategy that we suggest. It didn't work out like we want.
Maybe you can take another shot at explaining the biology of belzutifan. I love the diagrams, but I'm not sure I really grasp exactly what the biology is. Could you kind of go through the way you would explain it to a medical student?
Yes. So if you think about angiogenesis and if you think about renal cell cancer, really is defined in large part clear cell RC by this alteration in VHL. VHL is altered, there's a mutation, you know, it's a double hit. A gene alteration in VHL. Normally, a healthy protein, which we don't have in clear cell RCC, is part of a machinery, not only VHL, but VHL is a big part of it, that take some factor, let's say HIF2. HIF2 is bad, okay, it's the evil. That take HIF2 and degrade it in the proteasome, which is, you know, kind of like the, you know, the environmental services of the cell in part, okay? But when VHL, you know, there are other factors, but VHL is the one in clear cell RCC. When the VHL protein is truncated, is not healthy, etc., that proteasome is not working, so HIF2 is overexpressed. It's just, you know, crime. It's just, you know, happy. And it binds to its partner and lead to the, it's a transcription factor. And the transcription factor are not cell surface. It's very hard to have a drug that goes there into those pockets until recently. And it leads to the transcription of multiple hundreds of protein and gene, multiple genes that lead to protein. One of them is VEGF. But there are so many other, erythropoietin, et cetera, and a lot of these drive cancer. So an idea in the past that Dr. Kalin and several others had, that targeting HIF2 should really is ahead of these downstream factor and should lead to a better cancer control. And now we know that that's a valid target. Now, of course, people like me always want 100% response rate to get rid of everything, but it's never a perfect story, you know? But it's a story as close to perfect as possible, in part led to the Nobel Prize, etc. And now we have a drug, you know, belzutifan, and hopefully other drug coming, other HIF2 inhibitor, where we can combine them, they're safe, etc. So that's the whole story. Is that medical student like or PhD?
No, that was good. That helped a lot. And your diagrams in the talk were really good too. Is this like a competitive inhibitor for HIF?
It's allosteric.
And the other thing that you were commenting on that I wasn't aware of is with belzutifan or some of the toxicity or side effects, say the hypoxia, anemia, which makes a lot of sense. But can you talk a little bit about sort of what happens that leads to, you know, anemia, for example, or hypoxia? What's going on?
It's by dropping erythropoietin. So that's one of the downstream, by dropping erythropoietin, as one of the downstream those genes we really talked about. And how belzutifan you work, it binds to a pocket in HIF2, and so that HIF2 is not dimerized. It's destabilized that dimerization of HIF2 alpha and HIF1 beta through an allosteric effect. So remember the HIF2 to go and do the effect, it has to dimerize with HIF1 beta. I think it's called also ARNT. So when belzutifan is there going into this pocket, it's a small pocket, it's a pass B pocket domain, you know, very small resolution. It's measured in angstrom, HIF2 alpha. So HIF2 alpha cannot dimerize and do the bad stuff, you know, it does.
And I don't know if this is too simple of a interpretation, but in the sporadic RCC, you know, you see a lot of VHL alterations. These are somatic mutations?
In RCC somatic?
Yeah. No, yes, RCC yeah. Sporadic.
Yeah, sporadic. These are the mutation you see VHL. Yes, they're in the tumor.
And in the VHL syndrome, though, that's genetic?
They're germline.
Germline.
You know, but also if you test that tumor, you will find the mutation because it's also
sure,
the germ.
Both. Yeah, of course,
both,
right.
Germline, so you get it from the blood.
And do you see that in non-clear cell RCC?
You do not. You do not. Although there are, see, it's a bit different. So you do not. That's the easy answer. But the, a bit more complex answer is that there are cases labeled non-clear cell, like the unclassified renal cell, where we do genomic analysis and you find a VHL mutation. It's like, well, this should be maybe relabeled clear cell, but it's not like that on the histology. So sometimes the histology and the molecular analysis does not fit 100%, though most of the time it fits very well.
Any myths or misperceptions you see in the community about the management of renal cell? I know you see a lot of second opinions of patients who've been managed in the community. Anything that you see that maybe would be worth commenting on?
I am very impressed with how the community has embraced renal cell therapies. I mean, we used to say, hey, nivo ipi, we shouldn't give it in the community, although knowing the ipi in renal cell is 1 mg/kg, is the lower dose. But I'm so impressed by the community of oncologists around us. For example, I get a lot of referral, New England, New York, doing a great, great job. Most of the time, the second opinion is just for assurance, sometimes driven by the family, or for clinical trial when patient has been on several line of therapy, or for a frontline trial to establish care. So if we have a trial, the patient sometimes stays. You know, I think I am really impressed with the community and how we were able to work with our community oncologists together, how much they really learned about the TKI and immunotherapy. So only good thing. I haven't had anything. Sometimes, you know, sometimes there is subtleties in the pathology, or sometimes the pathology is, it becomes a bit different because we do have the expertise. We have kidney cancer pathologist, but overall, it's always has been a positive experience.
Any thoughts about where we might be heading in the future, where we might be in 3 to 5 years with renal cell?
I like the HIF2 axis. I think some of the data are going to be positive. It's going to be part of combination. I think there is effort in cellular therapy. This is not just renal cell, you know, CAR T. NK CAR, CAR NK, et cetera, are coming. Some of it will be tested in renal cell cancer. We have several efforts here. Let's see how biomarkers, you know, are going to pan out, the genomic signature and the non-genomic signature overall. I think these are the very important, you know, ones. I think there are some drugs that may be optimized, like an Excel inhibitor, for example. You know, one thing that unfortunately failed, but that's the first attempt, is drugs that target the metabolic pathway, the glutaminase inhibitor. There was one glutaminase inhibitor. We had a lot of hope for that because renal cell really is a metabolic tumor. There was this study I presented a bit, Neil, Cabo plus the glutaminase inhibitor versus Cabo. That study, unfortunately, you know, did not yield positive result. But it shouldn't be that we shouldn't focus on tumor metabolism in renal cell cancer. It's just the first attempt. So the future remains to me a positive future for patients with kidney cancer.
You mentioned CAR T and cellular therapy. What kind of targets are they, you thinking about?
You know, CD70 is the one that comes to mind, expressed in renal cell cancer. I know there are folks exploring that. There are also some attempts looking at CD70 plus, CA9 together, bispecific, which could be even, more specific for renal cell cancer, so nothing goes on the other, normal tissue. And, I think remain to be seen. A lot of the work was in preclinical now, and it's moving to clinic.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Chueri, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.